Quick update. I'm launching a new course for 2025. It's Foundations of Application Security. It's a two-day bootcamp covering everything you need to become a well-rounded AppSec practitioner. There's both public and private courses available, and the best part about it all is taught by me. So if you're interested, just send me an email, call@galahcyber.com.au, or say hi on LinkedIn if you can have a chat about it.
Quality software is secure software. So if you're a craftsman and you do care, you do want your code to be secure.
Hi, I'm Cole Cornford, and this is Secured, the podcast that dives deep into the world of application security. In this episode, I speak with Ken Johnson, co-founder of Dryrun Security and a co-host of the Absolute AppSec podcast. I've been listening to Absolute AppSec for years, and it's really good to have Ken on. Ken's got many years' experience working AppSec, as you'll probably gather from our conversation. He's helped build application security programs at GitHub and LivingSocial, done a bunch of InfoSec consulting earlier in his career, and more recently founded a company that really puts context as the most important thing for improving secure development. We chat about having an agnostic approach to AppSec instead of one that's a bit too bespoke, transitioning from being an employee to a founder, how artificial intelligence might change cybersecurity, and plenty more. So let's dive right in. Welcome, Ken. How you going, mate?
Great. And once again, thank you for having me on your podcast. I really appreciate it.
That's no worries at all, mate. So first question, as I say for all the guests who jump on to Secured, what kind of bird are you and why?
Yeah, I was going to tell you. So yeah, I have a story about the bird I wanted to bring up. But I don't relate to a pigeon at all. But I do have a story about a pigeon where I might have accidentally punched a pigeon at AppSec Cali years ago. Like I think, I don't know, maybe 2016, I think. Here's what happened. I'm sitting down at a couch. I've got some folks I worked with, Abdullah Munawar, really great guy sitting right there. We're trying to eat. This pigeon won't leave us alone. Pecking at us, trying to get to our food. I jokingly put my fist towards it and was like nudging towards it, and the bird like and I collided as it started to move, and basically I punched a pigeon. So that was the story I wanted to bring up about birds. But no, I'd say I'm probably more like a woodpecker. I just bang my head against my desk all day long. That's probably the most realistic.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, I've had a couple of incidents with birds. None of them are, I don't know, we'll see how upset my viewers get, but one time I was in Croatia in Dubrovnik, and we got a kayak, and I had like a foot long Subway sandwich in the kayak, and I just went around the island out off Dubrovnik's coast and then came back to the shore. And then I noticed there was just the seagull just pecking at my bag while I was trying to get dragging my thing on.
Yeah, yeah.
And eventually it pulled out the entire sandwich, stuck it in its mouth like this, and then I chased after it with my kayak, like, or screaming at it, being like, give me back my sandwich. I have just kayaked around an island for 2.5 hours while it flew off in the distance.
Imagine what that looked like to everybody watching that. Just this crazy scene of you chasing after a bird,
right,
for a sandwich.
It was amazing, God. Because there was like 40 other people in the kayaking group, and they were all like dying hysterically laughing at me, being like, I can't believe this bloke had his sandwich stolen, yeah, by a bloody seagull off the coast.
You're probably like hungry for, did you get food after that? I mean, were you hungry all day or?
Oh no, mate, I was on one of those like top deck cruises, so you just, what you do is you just go into the city and start drinking alcohol, right? So this is when I was a lot younger.
nice.
I know I was a little,
that's awesome,
a little bit not feeling so great the next day, but it is what it is, right? That seagull ruined everything. It wasn't my own bad decisions that night.
Is that the bird that's stuck in your mind since then? Is that the bird that comes to top of mind for you now?
No, I've got plenty of other bloody bird stories as well. Like even like locally next to my house, we get just kookaburras constantly. Just kookaburras and birds that just laugh all the time. Yeah. For those who are not Australian.
I've never heard of this.
Yeah, they have a habit of like diving in front of my car to go grab like insects because I live near swampland. And so I drive along my street like a granny now because I'm just afraid of hitting the kookaburras. There's just too many of them. Yeah. Scary animals.
So they make audible laughter?
Oh, you haven't heard a kookaburra laugh before?
No. Never. I've been twice, but I've never. Yeah, I've never heard that.
Mate, they're also called the Bushman's alarm clock for a reason, because about 6 o'clock in the morning, it's just like a hysterical laughter just that screams around my neighborhood, and you're like, "Yep, yeah, they are here." I'll send you a link to a kookaburra laughing afterwards. We have a bunch of stupid birds in Australia, so a lyrebird's another one that I like.
The wildlife in general down there is very, very different, very unique. It's really wild wildlife.
Growing up in Australia, I pretty much encounter an animal, and then I'm immediately like, fight or flight, what do I do? I have to think about it, like, very carefully. And one time, I was at Menlo Park. You can hazard a guess as to what company's at Menlo Park.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was there, and a squirrel walked in front of me, and everybody else was just jogging past a squirrel on their lunch breaks and so on. And I'm sitting there staring at this thing being like, what do I do? Do I like...
Are we going to fight? Is this what's going to happen now? Squirrel?
Literally like a random encounter. And like no one else really... I was just like kind of petrified, being like, I just have no idea how to respond to this creature. So anyway, I just walked at it after like 5 minutes of standing in fear while it's staring at me. And then it just ran away. And I was like, great. All right, squirrels...
Squirrels are okay.
Yeah, they're fine.
Squirrels are safe. They're fine. I don't have to worry. That's hilarious. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff I learned when I was out in Australia about wildlife that it amazed me. And like some of them are quite dangerous. And yeah, definitely would keep you on your toes. So I understand that for sure.
How often have you come to Australia?
Just so I think 2019, and I want to say 2018 maybe or something like that. I mean, I think it was 2018, 2019 consecutively. And then obviously the pandemic hit, and then, you know, that closed things down for a while. And I don't know, like for you all, are things kind of getting back to normal with conferences and things like that?
Oh yeah, I have a funny couple of weeks coming up. I'm going to be talking about artificial intelligence in the AppSec domain, actually on Saturday. So, a few days. So
that's amazing.
We have like a few big conferences and a couple of smaller ones. So the big Australian conference is B-Sides Canberra. It's about 3,000 security professionals, which is quite a lot in a relatively small country. And most of the other ones attract about 200 to 300 people. So I'm going to the smaller ones to talk about AI and AppSec. And then I'm at a couple of the places I'm working at, I'm going to try practically running it out, and then in a year's time submitting the practical results of how badly it goes, or great.
Yeah, or great.
It could be great, but I'm also a measured security professional who's worked in this industry for a while and knows that
we're all cynical.
Look, cynical, there is no silver bullet. As much as people love saying it could be AI, I'm just careful about preaching is going to change the world. But yeah, I'm doing that on Saturday, so that's going to be an interesting talk. Hopefully get a bunch of nice reception from folk, being like, and a lot less people asking about the top 10.
Yeah,
because AppSec's pretty nascent here, so.
Man, wow. That's awesome to hear. You know, you're out there, conferences are happening, you know. It's nice to have this all back to normal and feeling like, you know, being able to connect in person with people again. So it's super nice.
So for our audience members, Ken likes to run a training course with his friend Seth. They travel around the world and attach to the different conferences, and they teach people the good word about application security and how to do code review effectively. You have excellent adventures in it. So where did it come from? Where did you guys meet and start running this? Because you've been running this podcast for quite a long time now and doing the course too.
Yeah. So Seth and I first met when we worked at, well, he actually interviewed me for my first job outside DOD. So US like military contracting, but in security. So my first professional security job was in the DOD or not. I was contracting for the DOD. In any case, for my first sort of like commercial private sector position, this was Fishnet Security. And the person that interviewed me was Seth. He was the lead on the team. He was like the principal engineer. You know, to this day, I still even look at him a bit as a mentor. He's incredibly experienced, but we got along well. I think, you know, just through the years, we had worked again together. I kind of recruited him over to be a partner at a security consulting firm that we were both at before we kind of chose to depart from there. So he started his own business at that point, you know, Redpoint Security. I moved over to GitHub. And, you know, we've kept in contact. We're like good friends, you know. And like I said, we've worked together for quite a few years. So we know each other pretty well. And we were talking at, I think it was maybe CactusCon in Phoenix, Arizona. We were talking about how like secure code review material out there was all very language specific. So it would be very heavy on Java, right? And it would follow maybe like, you know, the OWASP top 10. And just in a practical sense for what you face on a day-to-day basis as either a consultant or, you know, a practitioner internally at a company, you know, it's not the top 10 that always bite you. They certainly don't manifest in, you know, that list is great for awareness, but doesn't capture everything that actually manifests. Your day-to-day challenges aren't necessarily just vulnerabilities, right? You know, the secure code material that was out there, it was just like very language specific. The categories were just very limited, and we felt like there needed to be something a little bit more applicable and something that's repeatable. So when we started talking, we realized like we have, about our methodologies anyways, about how we secure, like do secure code review, we started realizing, hey, there's a lot of overlap in our methodology, and I think we can like build this into a system and share this with other people. And I think the first few times we did it, it was just completely free workshops, or at least like the initial idea of it, not the full course. The full course, I think the first time we did it was at like AppSec USA or something along those lines. But what we found was what we were teaching really resonated with people, which is an agnostic approach. So what I mean by that is, you as a consultant might today be working on a Golang app, but next week someone might hand you a Node.js app and say like, hey, figure out how, you know, Next.js works. And you're like, all right, well, I've got 2 weeks to do an assessment, and I also have to like learn this new framework. And that is a realistic scenario that people come across. And as we've shared in the course, there's a lot of nuances, you know, in these frameworks and in the tech stacks you're using. So we give people an approach on how to build all of essentially context on using a bunch of different data points, getting to know the application, getting to understand its composition, its purpose. And yeah, it's just a repeatable system for taking an agnostic approach to saying like, here's something you've never seen before. Let's do a code review on it and be comprehensive, be timely, probably not catch all the low hanging fruit. Just focus on take a risk-based kind of approach. I know it's a super long winded answer, but that's the full story.
It's a really good one, though, and it echoes my experience within Australia. I started learning application security basically from reading Vulncat descriptions from the fortified taxonomy of security vulnerabilities, if you are aware of that. It's a lot, I know. Back then, I fully understand you can't scan everything with the static analysis tool, so you need to have approaches for dealing with technology because it's changing a lot. Back when I was starting out, everything was MVC and Spring Boot was just starting to be a thing. And because of that, you know, we had all these static analysis tools that were really, really geared for Java and .NET. And all of the training material was, you know, by the vendors who built these tools, also geared for Java and .NET. And, you know, of course, fast forward a decade, now the world is a hodgepodge of all sorts of different things. Microservice architectures, you got infrastructure as code, software-defined networks, you got, who knows, mate, I come across all sorts of stuff. I am really happy when someone comes to me and they say, I have 6 Spring Boot applications, and I'm like, wow, all right, let's do it. You know, I'm also not happy when they say, I need something that can analyze protobuf, and I'm like, it doesn't go into burp.
Yeah, and that is the reality. Our tooling, you know, by nature, we are always behind the curve, right? Because we are following the trends software developers are building. I came to this epiphany way too late in life or in my career, but that, you know, hey, like we're always going to be behind. We're always adapting, but because we're adapting, we're always behind. And they're leading the charge on the specs, on the protocols they're using, the languages they're using, and just the tech stacks in general. So we just were reacting, but if we don't have some good systems in place, and this is, I know we're going to get into it because I want to talk about AI in AppSec with you, because I am currently interested in AI in AppSec in an AppSec context. So yeah, anyways, I think things are evolving. I think using more than just really just like a static scanner kind of result, or even just dynamic scanner kind of result, there's more to understand about changes that are occurring in code bases. There's more things to just like understand in general in terms of, and this is actually, I'm going to maybe briefly take a tangent or go off on a tangent here.
Yep.
But I think like AppSec's actually getting much harder, because before software security was basically what you said, right? Like you have a Spring Boot application or, you know, a classic ASP app or whatever. And it's like, or a PHP app. And, you know, it's like, hey, the file and the folder structure is like mapped to a URL and everything's really simple. And it's like just an app. And now you're dealing with like all these different networking protocols, and you are dealing with, you know, of course, on top of the software, you're dealing with, you know, system level stuff like Kubernetes and Docker, and you're dealing with cloud services. Like, I mean, you know, years ago, we started implementing serverless with Lambda, and now the things that AWS or Azure offer, like in terms of services, it's just like, man, you can basically build an application without ever building an app. Not basically, you can build applications without building, you know, a traditional web application, to your point. So you have to know a set, or you have to have essentially a lot of different skill sets. But underpinning all of that is really, really understanding the fundamentals really, really well. And that's something I think is getting harder for AppSec people, but it's more necessary. We really have to be good at the fundamentals, is what I'm trying to say.
So I run a training course for people who are looking to move into application security as opposed to product security or DevSecOps. I really don't like either of those terms. That it is what it is. But when I say application security, I think about managing risk holistically for software engineering for an organization. And then I think product security is, you have a product, let's manage the risk for that particular product. And for DevSecOps, I just think of, let's just put a bunch of tools in the DevOps pipeline, and they're probably security tools, you know? So I think that it's incredibly difficult as an AppSec person to have great interpersonal skills and the ability to empathize and have people want to work with you and listen to your ideas, to win hearts and minds and to be a kind person, as well as being technically brilliant across all disciplines and domains and having some idea about security. So the agnostic approach that you teach is something that I like build into my courses as well. I don't teach code review, but I do teach engineers that they should be thinking about risk, thinking about threat modeling, and thinking about architecture. And then how does that all fit into whatever they're trying to do in their day-to-day lives as far as delivering features or other non-functional requirements? It's an evolving challenge. I don't think we'll ever quite solve it, but it's been a fun journey.
But you're teaching them sort of a methodology around the sort of fundamental understanding of risk and how that presents itself in their work. And that lends itself to flexibility. So whatever they're faced with, at least they have like a structural foundation with these fundamentals to build upon and adapt to whatever project they're on, whatever they're dealing with. But you're absolutely right. Like, I would say that was probably one of my favorite things about GitHub, was that everybody was so kind and empathetic and helpful. And really, I think the culture while I was there, that was pretty much across the board. I never really experienced too much in the way of any negativity. And I think our teams, from engineering to operations to security, legal, HR, we all worked really well together, just because everybody was, you know, they carried those qualities within themselves.
I'm actually good friends with a lot of the hubbers out this way, so.
Oh, nice. That's awesome.
Yeah. You probably know my good mate, Shlomi, actually.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Shlomi's awesome. We had Shlomi on once. We have Shlomi coming up twice. He's coming on for a part two. Because I was like, I don't know, man. I was kind of like fanboying out pretty heavy because I really respect him. We didn't get to nearly any of the topics we wanted to talk about. So it was immediately derailed by me just being like, oh my gosh, Shlomi's so cool. So anyways, and thank you for the introduction, because it's funny, we worked in the same company for I don't know how long, never talked, you know, didn't know each other. And then you made that connection. So I really appreciate that. He's awesome.
Yeah, it's all good. That's one of the things I'm finding that kind of sucks from the pandemic, actually. Just the whole remote work aspect means that people aren't really meeting each other accidentally in the elevator or at the coffee shop or at the bar or whatever. So I try to make sure I go to a bunch of events in person nowadays just to see who I bump into. Mostly GitHub Galaxy and Universe, but that's all right. So
how are those? What do you think of them?
Oh, so, well, without being like too rude to GitHub, obviously it's extremely sales focused.
No, honest review. I don't work there now, so yeah, don't worry about
it. No, I know. But like it's extremely sales focused, and I think I really like the pivot that they're doing, because GitHub Advanced Security is unfortunately quite difficult to sell in the Australian market. Not because it's a bad product, but because people don't even think of GitHub as anything except as SCM, right? And when it's all people know of it is just that's the place open source is, how are you going to sell all your other products with it? Now, that's shifted tremendously with artificial intelligence and Copilot. And I'm actually trying to drive conversations to now that we have stakeholders who have a GitHub, you know, tenancy somewhere, and we think about them and say, well, how can we now leverage artificial intelligence to improve AppSec? Because what we've been doing in the past of just, you know, let's teach developers about security and everything will be good. Wait, no, that's not working because we have constant churn and the engineers who are really good move on to big tech companies like GitHub in the end anyway. So all that time you've invested in these people isn't actually resulting in more secure software. Or you send them out into, you know, training platforms, don't want to mention names, but if they're out of their daily context, what they're doing in their day-to-day work, and then they come back, that context switching is going to be killer and they're not going to retain it, the information that they learn elsewhere. So, and then I think about some of the big issues of security is it's almost always a cost center, right? Everything you're doing is creating friction and problems to the business at the end of the day. So if as soon as you introduce artificial intelligence as a way to say, hey, let's accelerate how fast you can do things and reduce the cost of these activities and make friction slightly more Teflon-y, then they're going to be open-minded about it at the very least, because it's better than getting a two-week pen test every single time you release an app, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think you touched on a lot of different things there. Like, yes. So training's a tough one. Actually, to your point, getting developers to do anything outside of what like needs to be done for that sprint or for that ship or whatever, it's just difficult in general. And also, like, a lot of the training, you kind of find that there's like some of your shining stars, and most people kind of go through the training and they might retain some of it, but maybe there will be like, I don't know, 8 to 10% of the people that took it that are really into it. And those are the people that tend to be your what became security champions, right? And one of the things that's like interesting about that is now you've got folks who are kind of what they're given is like maybe some SaaS tooling or some tooling of some kind, or like a GitHub Advanced Security. And that's kind of what they're given as a like signal that there might be something going on some of the code that their team owns or something like that. Basically, what I'm saying is security people kind of have to offload some of that responsibility to a person, and then that person has to use maybe like a tool or something to maybe get some kind of warning that like they need to maybe go look at it and help out because they're the security person for that team, or the, you know, delegated security person for that team. It's just, I don't think like that alone, just the training aspect that you touched on and how that basically is supposed to work and that trickle down effect, it hasn't, like, I don't know if it's really hit the mark the way it should. You know what I mean? I think when I look at it from a practical standpoint, when people who have been security champions in the past have found things, it's been by like a lucky coincidence, or they knew of maybe a sizable ship. That's kind of like where you get some awareness. And so that can be valuable. But, you know, offloading like the review of security results, or just kind of being there to have some level of assurance that the code changing on a daily basis is secure, it's kind of rough, you know. And then you know, we could talk about tooling and procedures and all that all day long. There's flaws in all of it, but I won't go off on another tangent.
Let's stay on education for a bit though, right? So
yeah,
I have a couple of views about it. I figured that if you training engineers like in facilitator-led instructed learning, then that's really good for their careers and they get some really helpful knowledge if it is agnostic. So then they can apply it across all, whatever they're doing on a day-to-day basis. But you're right. I think that if you have a classroom of 20 people, 2 to 3 people are really interested in security and other people are interested in front-end frameworks and CSS and like cloud environments, and they're obviously going to gravitate to managing the things that they find really good, whether it's spaces and tabs or...
And there's nothing wrong with that, right? I mean, I think that that's... And yeah, no, and the spaces versus tabs and all, you know, like, I do think that, that's okay. Like, that's totally fine. That's if that's what you're interested in and that's what makes you happy and that's why you chose this job and you're not interested in security, like, I do think that, you know, to the point I think you're kind of making with Copilot and AI helping out with maybe being some guardrails there, which I don't know if that's what you're saying. I just assume that's kind of where you're going with that. But if you are, I do agree. I think like giving some guardrails is much more helpful than, yeah, trying to infuse something someone's not interested in on them. But I do want to say this though. So I'm going to like throw out something that contradicts myself though, because
we love that
quality software is secure software. So if you're a craftsman and you do care, you do want your code to be secure. It just may be that either the way you're being trained or whatever, it's just not resonating with you. And that's totally fine. You know, that's something that we in security kind of have to figure out. But I would say, yeah, quality software is secure software.
Yeah, I do agree with that. I think that it's the reason that we call it software engineering, is that you have a lot of things that you need to be building into place and really thinking about, that you're not just going to like put up a bridge so you can cross the river straight away. Here's a piece of wood. Don't worry if it gets slippery or wet or whatever, or rots. Like, it's only meant to cross for a day. Oftentimes we take that approach to software when, you know, that system could be in use for decades.
Yeah.
And I have seen systems that are in use for decades.
Hey, and they run some serious critical infrastructure too, so can't knock them. I guess what's the saying, like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it?
That's it.
That applies here.
So with AI, now my idea for dev training with AI is that developers need stuff that is front of mind and relevant to what they're doing at that point in time. And what I've seen in the past before they got acquired, that was a good step in this direction, was the company called Codebashing, which I think is now part of Checkmarks, where a developer would write something and then the spell check would say, like, this looks like SQL injection, and give you a little context in the IDE that you made some mistakes, right? What I think is actually going to be a lot better is with Copilot Chat, which I think is in beta at the moment. But the general idea is that autocorrect or identify security vulnerabilities while you're just writing your software. And then instead of just being given something that an expert has written, you would be using an LLM to generate content that's probably mostly correct. Like, you know, I know that some security guy is going to get up and angry at me and say, like, oh, large language models are just going to, you know, say hallucinate and produce all sorts of garbage about SQL injection. Therefore, you just should never rely on it. But I figured that's why we have defense in depth. And also, there's people who are joking because static analysis tools and SCA and WAFs are false positives constantly anyway, right? So it's not like it's any different. But the reason I think it's going to be a bit of a, you know, nail in the coffin for a lot of these like Udemy's and Coursera's and so on that teach like how to write secure software, or here's the top 10, is in the language that you are using at that point in time, with context of the code base that you're writing in and your business context, here is a little bit of guidance. And then you can follow on from that guidance and say, sorry, I didn't understand this because this part was too lengthy, or like you used too much jargon, or I just need a different way of viewing that, right? And that's what AI is really good at producing. Whereas, you know, if I go back and think about my early days with Volncat, yeah, it was experts who wrote extremely good content, but that content wasn't relevant to what I was reading.
Yeah. Well, man, so I agree with you. I have so many thoughts. Where to begin? So with dry run,
yep.
That's kind of part of, not like fully what we're doing, but that's definitely a part of the idea, right? Is having a bunch of different data points to build up and use as context to surface sort of risk, and then have first level triage covered, right? So we have a security buddy kind of thing, helps you, you know, figure out what you need to do next. And there's some other stuff we're doing that I won't get into. But what I will say is, on the point of the cynicism that I've seen around LLMs, I get it. I totally understand past historical examples and whatnot. Having said that, lately I've been working with like LangChain. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Yep.
But it's a good way to, create your own vectors, create your own chat prompt templates, essentially have a way to, you know, direct traffic to your own data set and kind of give it, you know, some guidelines on what's okay to, you know, how to talk, how to speak to the person, what's professional, what's not, things like that. But my point here is that you can get pretty granular in where it looks for certain data. Anyways, why I think that's pretty incredible is a few reasons, right? Instead of just going up to OpenAI's like huge database and huge AI modeling, you know, get results that are, you were talking about, I think, SQL injection, right? Like poor SQL injection grammar, or, you know, maybe a poor explanation, or just didn't make any sense. Well, you can avoid all that through using something like a LangChain and the OpenAI library. So, and by the way, anybody can do this. They just, you know, it's open source. It's on, use Python, try it out. Maybe it'll surprise you, because I think it gets pretty interesting when you have control over the parameters of where, you know, what data is being used for what information is being requested. On top of that, you know, everybody talks about the chat bit, but there's a lot more underneath the hood. And again, going back to LangChain, if you look at some of like the documentation around agents and what's possible there, I think there is a place to feed it quite a bit of very contextually specific information and produce very valuable, quick results, which, you know, I don't want to go too far into it, given, you know, I am building a company, but anyways, it's very interesting. I understand the cynicism, but at the same time, I think if you start actually using AI, you might be surprised at what you can do.
Yeah, I think there's a tremendous amount of people out there who are just writing, here's the top 10 ways you can solve AI. And it's something like fill a glass of water or plan your day. And then everyone's like, okay, cool. Look at all of these Yahoos online saying stupid stuff, right? But there are people out there who are actually really thinking about challenges that, you know, we can't do without having something like this. And I know Daniel Miesler is someone who's been spending a tremendous amount of time saying that the way that we're going to be producing software in 5 to 10 years, although he thinks it's 2 to 3, I'm going to go 5 to 10, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
It's going to be fundamentally different, right? And I don't want to give up any of your secret sauce for Dryrun, but, you know, hey guys, go have a look at Dryrun Security. Cool guys. They've got some interesting stuff happening in the future.
Thanks. But no, I mean, you know, honestly, I do think like AI is a huge technological leap forward. Don't sleep on it. Play with it. Try it. And I think we're hackers, right? Innovation is sort of like a part of who we are. And I think if you start playing around with it and get to know the various libraries and services and just what's available, you know, how it all works, you'd be surprised.
So how is it going? Because your career spanned consulting and then moved over to, you know, working as a permie at GitHub. And now you're running your own company, right? So what's it like transitioning into being a founder?
So I've done this role of being a CTO and technically not a founder on paper, but had worked kind of on the side, building up a consultancy. So not quite a co-founder, but kind of, right? And that was a bootstrap business. So, you know, we made our own income through doing services, through consulting service. So whether it's training or assessments or whatever, that's how we made our income. And this is a VC-backed venture, right? So yeah, venture capital firm plus angel investors. So it's very different. You know, I was building a product, right? So that the goal was like, we paid the bills through the consulting service work. And the goal was to build a product at the end of the day with what time we had left. That was challenging, right? Like, how many hours can you actually work on the product? Whereas it's very nice in this environment because this is all I do, right? Is I just work on the product. It's incredible. It's a huge fun. It's a huge undertaking. It's challenging and it's super, super fun. You know, I've got great investors, great team. My co-founder, James Wickett's awesome. He really is. Like if anybody knows James, he's, you know, or if you don't know him, he had founded LastCon, like DevSecOpsCon or conference or something like that. And DevOps Days, Austin, which by the way, even he, the DevSecOps names, he makes jokes about that. So anyways, privately though.
Yeah.
No, DevOps Days, Austin. So he's just been heavily involved in the community, in OWASP, in AppSec, in DevOps, and he's been a community builder. So anyways, it's great to work with him. It's weird though, because like my career has been all over the place, right? I've kind of just gone where I thought I would have fun, if I'm being honest. Like what was interesting at the time? That's just honestly all I've ever done, except for one case where, you know, I had to pay bills.
Yep.
Chartered communication. But anyways, yeah, besides that, you know, just interesting stuff. And so it's taken me everywhere. I've been a consultant. I've worked at Living Social back when Living Social and Groupon were a thing. I don't know if y'all remember that, but I built a company as a CTO, went to GitHub, worked there, had almost 6 years of like the best, like one of the best times of my career. That was super fun. And yeah, now I'm here doing this CTO role again and building something I really, really believe in.
It's funny, I've spoken to a number of founders in Australia or people who are intending to found a company. And a lot of them do fall into that trap where they say, I'm going to go do security architecture consulting and I'm going to earn bank 3 days a week. And then those last 2 days, I'm going to build my product. But then what they find is actually they're working 60 hours a week of consulting. They have no time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's in. And on top of the consulting, you got the paperwork to handle, you've got people stuff to work through, you know, you're always doing some level of marketing, blogging, you know, well, I guess blogging is a part of marketing, right? But you're always working on something. There's always something that needs to be done. Also with services, it's very cyclical. It's very difficult in that regard. I mean, I assume the economics are the same out where you're at, where it's like there is, you know, a kind of a surge through Q4. Where everybody's got to kind of burn through their budget. And then that's when, you know, services get hit really hard. Lots of people need lots of stuff. But then it kind of just dries up for, you know, a couple quarters, or not dries up completely, but it like definitely a steep decline in the new year. And it's just a tough one. It's such an up and down business. So doing that and trying to build software is a very, very hard thing to do. And everybody tells you that. And you know, me, I was hard headed. I didn't believe it. Until I lived it.
it's so easy to have to listen to other people, but oftentimes you won't do that unless you go to school yourself, because you got to go to the school of hard knocks. And it sucks, but going to school, those lessons stick with you, right? When you fail and make mistakes, like I've done plenty of them. I started my consultancy business without actually ever having done consulting previously.
That is a bold undertaking.
How crazy am I, mate? I'm just like, you know what Australia needs? AppSec. Yes, my friend said, you are a brave man. And I didn't realize that brave was a synonym for stupid at the time. So
that's so hilarious.
Oh, so man. Anyway, I did learn is a tremendous amount of things, like managing cash flow, and like the consultancy salaries are not going to be the same as permanent staff members. Contingent workforces are a thing. Christmas is a thing. You learn to hate Christmas. So.
Yeah, you know, it's always a tough one, because, you know, you want to give in a traditional, like a GitHub, for instance, right? We had like, I think the last 2 weeks of it was more like kind of the last 3 weeks, but it was, you know, definitely the last 2 weeks of December, you know, we just had that off. People got to go just relax. And I was like, this is incredible. I haven't felt this in years. This is amazing. Like who does this? You know, I mean, because with consulting, yeah, it's like you said, like, I mean, there were times it's pretty much Christmas Eve and I'm trying to like get something done, or someone has a question or something, and it's like, man, you can't even enjoy the holidays. So anyways, it's a rough time. It's a rough time.
So outside of cybersecurity, what do you really like to do in your spare time? What's cool and interesting?
Well, you know, I have a family, so I have a wife and a 10-year-old son, almost 11 now. You know, he and I spend a lot of time together, right? Lately, we've been doing 3D printing. I've kind of gotten into that with him, trying to get him into like some of the science and technology stuff, you know, he had wanted to print out like a Star Wars, some toys and a uniform and stuff like that. And I was like, yeah, we can totally do that. It's like teach you about printing and painting and sanding and all these like, you know, useful skills. Beyond that, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu takes up a lot of my time. Well, a lot of my free time, I should say, outside of what little free time I do have, BJJ takes up. Yeah. Is actually a more accurate way of saying it.
Especially as a founder.
Yeah, exactly. So any free time I have. But yeah, I do it competitively. And, well, I smoke meats and do a lot of barbecue. So beyond that, yeah, that's it.
Okay. What got you into BJJ? Because I've listened to a few Sam Harris podcasts where they've had a few instructors on who've talked about their journeys and that, but you know, I'm not really someone who knows martial arts particularly well. So what got you into it?
Well, my buddy who I was in the Navy with, actually, so I was in the U.S. Navy. I visited him actually for LASCON, funny enough. He lived in San Antonio. He lives in San Antonio. So I went down from Austin, visited him, hung out with him and his wife, just kind of caught up. And he was talking about UFC. And I, by the way, still never watched a UFC match.
Me either, don't worry.
Yeah, I'm not really into it. But, I get it, whatever. So he was watching that, and he was talking about jiu-jitsu and how he had done jiu-jitsu. And at first I was like, dude, why would I want to go to the, like, roll around on the ground with somebody? Like, that seems ridiculous. It's not how you fight, right? Because, like, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, right? So it's like Jean-Claude Van Damme and Arnold Schwarzenegger. So it's punching, yeah.
Yep.
Anyway, so he was like, no, look at the percentage of, so I did, I looked up the percentage of you know, like if you were to get into an altercation, like what, you know, what percentage goes to the ground? That was interesting to me. And it was like, okay, so obviously it happens a lot. And like, that's like most cases. And yeah, this would be a fun thing to do. So I was like, all right, well, I want to do this. But then I went and did the bootstrapped company where I like literally worked, I mean, insane hours. Like there were times I slept in the office. I mean, we're talking for a few hours and then was right back at it. So that was a pretty crazy endeavor at times, just totally unable to do it. So then when I went to GitHub, I was like, you know what? That was really rough on my body and my psyche. I was definitely overweight. I was big. I was overweight. I was inflexible. I was very immobile too, like from sitting in a chair for years and working in front of a computer and typing on a keyboard, you know, hour after hour, day after day. So I'm like, well, let me do this thing I always wanted to do anyways. And I went in and then I fell in love with all these other like aspects of it. It's very addictive. People call it like human chess, and that's very, very accurate. It is like very addictive. That's how I kind of started it. And now it's just a full on addiction, you know, it occupies a lot of time. Well, again, a lot of any free time I have.
Are you doing it competitively too?
Yeah, Friday I'm flying out to Austin to just do like an open, IBJJF open. And then that's a precursor. This is kind of funny. Like DEF CON and Black Hat happen for me kind of mid-August just because like I have to stay for the DEF CON training, which is after that. So that leads me to a situation where I have 2 weeks between DEF CON Black Hat and the big tournament I do every year, World Masters. It's held in Vegas. And anyways, it's just, it's like, man, I'm going to spend half the month in Vegas. And, you know, anyone who's been to Las Vegas knows you don't want to spend half a month in Las Vegas. So it's going to be pretty interesting. Yeah.
Should just get a car and drive off somewhere and just go enjoy the countryside for like, I mean, it's all desert as far as I know, but maybe you'll find something. So
yeah, well, actually, I lived in Reno, Nevada for a while, which is like, I don't know. It's like a really worse version of Las Vegas. It's just, anyways, but it's the same kind of like, you know, yeah, just rocks for days and cactus and not much else.
So when the pandemic hit, I kind of did everything at the same time, you know, because I was initially going to fly over to live in British Columbia, Vancouver Island, so a city called Victoria.
Okay.
To go work as director of security at a company called Change.org. And that didn't happen because of COVID. I basically quit my comfy banking job and then moved to, sign my visa, moved back, sold all my possessions, moved back into my dad's house for about a day or two. And then we were told that the world is locked down. And I was like, great. All right. I don't have a job. They kept me on, thankfully. I just said, well, I can't really be a director remotely, so I'll be a staff security engineer. It's all good. Who cares, right?
Man.
And then during the pandemic, I met my wife. moved out with her. I had a dog. I bought a house. I started a business. I just did everything at the same time because, man, remote work gives you a lot of flexibility to do everything, I guess. So,
you know, that's the thing. Every time I've ever like followed what I thought just seemed cool, like interesting, is what I wanted to do. Maybe the thing I was doing wasn't like same as you. Like it ends in an outcome that is just way more interesting, way more fun. Yeah, definitely hard, definitely challenging, not like easy by any stretch. But man, does it. Yeah, you're excited to wake up. You're excited to do what you do every day. And life is good. And, you know, if life is good, your family feels that. They know that you're happy and it's good for them too.
I'm really happy to have a very supportive family. I know tomorrow's a bit intimidating for me, actually, because I have to give a speech at my local university for the graduation. It's called an occasional address. And it kind of scares me to think it's been exactly 10 years since I've graduated. And one of the things that I have to do is like, try to inspire these people,
yeah,
in some capacity, right? And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, well, what have I done that's been really good for my career? And part of that was the courage to just go out and just try things and take risks, right? Which is a bit kind of amusing for someone who works in cybersecurity trying to prevent risks, right?
But, well, it's calculated risk.
Calculated, right? Ah, dear.
But no, yeah, that's like, I think like, honestly, that's what leads to the best outcomes. Truly, is taking that step and just being brave and doing what you think is going to be fun. Even if it's hard. I mean, especially if it's hard, that's probably the right thing to do in a lot of cases.
That's it. Well, do we only grow when we're put into uncomfortable situations, right?
Completely agree. It's an opportunity.
Cool. Hey, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Ken. I've really enjoyed our conversation. I'll have to get you back sometime, like you do with Shlomi.
yeah, exactly.
Any shout-outs or things you'd like to say to wrap up for our viewers?
Well, you know, thank you again. This has been awesome. I really appreciate it. If your listeners aren't familiar, Absolute AppSec is a podcast that I run, like you mentioned, with Seth. Seth and I will be at DEF CON Las Vegas giving training. There's still seats open. Let's see. And yeah, we are moving into basically a private beta soon with dry runs. So, you know, be on the lookout for some notifications coming very soon about our product.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Secured. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Don't forget to follow the podcast on your favorite platform and leave us a review. Want some more content like the above? Why not subscribe to our newsletter at galarcyber.com.au/newsletter and get high quality AppSec content straight to your mailbox. Stay safe, stay secure, and we'll see you next episode.
If you're new to the show or a seasoned veteran, I want to hear from you. I'm always looking to do better as a podcast host and as a person. So tell me about what I can do better. Tell me about the types of people you want on my podcast. Tell me about if the format's working for you or styles need to be switched up. Do I need to interview differently? So on and so forth. I appreciate you sticking with me for almost 30 episodes at this stage. And I hope I can keep learning and you can keep learning and being entertained for many more episodes to come. So please shoot me feedback. I want the good, the bad, and the ugly to pod@galarcyber.com.au. And if you don't like email, hit me up on LinkedIn.